Some of you fellows I know from Spokesman's Club years ago, and the others I see across the room when we meet you at a holy day. Well, when I was a boy, I read a comic book version of a classic American short story called The Man Without a Country. It was about a lieutenant in the United States Army who was put up for treason. And in the process, he got very tired of the questioning in the military tribunal. And finally, he shouted out, and I quote, I got to get it right because I changed it a little bit. But the quote said, damn the United States of America. I wish that I may never hear of the United States again. And this took place about in the year 1807. But the presiding judge and the military officers, you see, had fought alongside of George Washington not that many years before. And just to make this man, allowed him to have such freedoms as to be in the country. Well, they retired to consider a judgment. And the judgment they came back forth was, Lieutenant Nolan, you desired never to hear the United States again. You shall have your wish. And the order went up for approval to the United States Secretary of Navy and came back down approved. And Lieutenant Nolan was taken out into the Atlantic Ocean, put aboard an American warship with instructions to the captain that his man should never see the United States again. Now, he was in his early 20s. And so from year to year, whenever he had to be transferred to another ship and that ship had to go see the United States, well, he was transferred. The new captain got the new orders, and Lieutenant Nolan never saw the United States again. Now, it became an American short story. It was read during the Civil War. The only difficulty was that the story wasn't accurate, meaning it never happened. Because the man who published the article in the Atlantic Monthly in 1863 wanted to get the people on the side of the Union Army and to preserve the Union. And that's right during that smack during the middle of the Civil War. So it became of such a short, famous short story because many men joined the Union cause because they loved the United States and didn't want to see the South seceding from the Union they wanted to preserve. Now, I didn't read it in a classic short story. Other people of you may have in high school, but my version was the comic book version. Here's Lieutenant Nolan out on the American warship fighting the British. And that was my introduction to A Fair and Miss American Short. I got this from eBay just to refresh my memory on the whole story. But there is a man in the Bible that I think we might fairly call a man without a country. This man was born in a country whose mother was a slave. He rose to great military accomplishment. And if you listen to him, you would say he was a stutterer. Yet he became one of the world's greatest authors. He hated the country that he was born in, wanted to leave it, wanted to get to a different country. In fact, he collected all the stories and learned everything he could about the country he wanted to go to. He learned about its history, its geography, its legendary figures. And he ended up giving everything he had to be able to get to that country. Like in the short story that I referred to, he never made it to that country. Now, if you haven't guessed, the man we're talking about today is Moses. And what I'd like to do with the time remaining is to go through a few occurrences in the life of Moses and see how they shaped him to become what we might fairly call a man without a country. And then what I'd like to do is to relate it to us today and see how Moses becoming a man without a country is significant to us. What do we know about Moses? Well, we know he was a Levite, wasn't he? He had the youngest of three children, older brother, older sister. And we know at the time of his birth, Pharaoh had given orders to toss all the newborn Hebrew babies into the Nile River. But the text says that when this, a particular mother, saw that the baby she had born was exceedingly beautiful, she couldn't bear to toss him into the Nile. You know the story? She popped him in a little basket, hid him among the reeds in the Nile, and hoped the crocodiles wouldn't get him. Now, as it happens, 400 years earlier, God made a promise to Abraham in the land of Canaan. He said, Abraham, I'm giving you all of this land, but you're not going to receive it. Your children, your descendants are going to go down into the land of Egypt. They're going to become slaves, and I'm going to bring them back here 400 years later, and they're going to inherit all the land that I'm giving to you. Well, the time was getting close. God needed an instrument and a vessel to fulfill this promise. So, in my imagination, and if the story plays out and we find later that this is true, I wouldn't be at all surprised. God may well have selected the sperm and the egg to come together to match up and meet the exact temperament of the man we call Moses. Now, I don't think it's an accident that Pharaoh's daughter came down to bathe in the Nile on the spot of the basket. Now, our Jewish friends tell us in commentaries that this daughter of Pharaoh's, the reason she came down to the Nile was that she had leprosy. She came to wash. And if we use our imaginations, we might imagine that this lady, if she indeed had leprosy, would not be a prime candidate for marriage, would she? And the idea of having a child of her own may long since have passed her. So when she opens the basket and she sees an exceptionally beautiful child, there may well have been a little tickle from God's mind saying, oh, and she wants to pick that baby up and cuddle the crying baby. Now, at that point, of course, you know the story. Moses' sister comes running over, clever little gal, because the baby's crying. How do you stop a baby crying? Well, the mother typically feeds her. If you have a bottle, that's the way I stop my girls from crying when they were growing up. And that was a perfect solution to a problem. So Miriam got a nurse for the mother and was paid for her. We don't have to turn there today because it's just one sentence for the sake of time. But if you want to write it down, Exodus chapter 2 and verse 10 tells us a singular conclusion. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 10. I'll read the sentence. It says, and the child grew, and she, that would be Moses' mother, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. I suppose that's better than having no son at all. At least know that your son is alive. Now, here's a couple of questions. We need to ask these questions. Did Moses know he was adopted? Did he know his father? Did he ever have contact with his mother and brother and sister? Did he know he was a Hebrew? Now, this is a relevant question because, you see, when the Pharaoh's daughter opened the basket, the first words were, oh, it's one of the Hebrew babies. And so I have to assume that the way that an Israelite looked was somewhat different than what an Egyptian baby looked like. How did Moses know, growing up in Pharaoh's court, that he was a Hebrew? Did his mother tell him? I have a brother who's adopted two children, one of which is from another race. And child development experts tell us that it's very important for a child to understand his identity and to have an identity. So how did Moses see himself? Was he a spoiled little rich kid running around the palace with no father? The Bible doesn't tell us, so we don't know. But we do know something happened. Something happened when growing up that made him make a choice. And we find this out in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, beginning in chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. Now, Jews, if you read in the New Testament, had more understanding and preserved more of their history than we have available today. And some of this creeps in the New Testament, actually enlightens us a great deal about what was going on. And starting in Hebrews 11, verse 24, it talks about Moses. And it says, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, so now he's now grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Now, a simple conclusion is, something happened. something happened in this man's mind to make him turn his back on everything he had. You know, rich kid in palace, could be like a kid in Beverly Hills, has Rolls Royce or the Maserati, lots of privileges other people have, turned his back on it. Why? Was it because he looked different than the other kids? Was it because he was a stutterer and the other Egyptian kids made fun of him? We're not told. Now, some adopted kids have no need ever to meet their biological parents. They're happy with mom and dad. That's who raised them, and they're fine with that. Others have an intense desire to find out who they are. And they'll spend tens of thousands of dollars. They'll try to search through sealed court records to find a clue as to who their biological parents are. So we have to assume that Moses went through an identity crisis. Who am I? And this man made a choice not just to become a commoner, but to identify with the people who were abject slaves, working ignominiously 7 days a week. And my own conclusion is, this is not that much different from some of us who might be first generation, where God is beginning to work on this man's mind, softening him up and preparing him for what he has later. If he didn't, the promises to Abraham of the Israelites coming back into the land of Canaan 400 years either would be at risk. Now, there's a defining moment, I believe, that happened in Moses' life. It's only a sentence. You can write it down if you like. It's Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11. It's real simple. I'll read it. It's one sentence. It says, "And it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren, and he looked on their burdens." Now, we find elsewhere that he's about 40 years of age at this point. Now, we know two things from this verse. First, he knew he was a Hebrew. He looked unto his brothers. And secondly, he looked on their burdens. This man identified with the burdens they were suffering. Now, if you were God, what kind of man would you pick? A hard-nosed man with no empathy? Or the man who is going to become the greatest deliverer in the history of Israel? This man chose to reject what he had, when he had all the goodies of the highest kingdom nation on earth, and he chose to identify. Now, the reason I think this is significant is picked up in the next verse, verse 11. You know this incident. It says, "And he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brothers. And he looked this way and that way. And when he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid his body in the sand." Now, our Jewish friends will tell us this isn't what it might seem at first blush. Because what's really going on here, mind you, this man was taken out by his Egyptian overseer to where nobody could see him. And our Jewish friends tell us what's really going on is this slave was being beaten to death. And Moses, you see, went and stopped a murder from occurring. And our Jewish friends point out, Old Testament scripture says, you have a moral duty, even if it takes a man's life, to stop an innocent from being murdered. And our Jewish friends would tell us, nowhere in the Bible are Moses' actions condemned. And this goes right to the heart of what kind of man did God have in mind to be the deliverer of Israel? One who put everything at risk to save one innocent, bedraggled, ignominious slave. Now, you know the story. Pharaoh got wind of it. Moses had to flee. Now he's out in the desert. And truly, at this point, Moses has become a man without a country. Now, you know the rest of the story. 40 years go by. Sun comes up. Sun goes down. He finds the burning bush. God speaks to him, sends him back to Egypt. He meets Pharaoh. We have the 10 plagues, the death of the firstborn, the crossing of the Red Sea, and the receiving of the 10 commandments in Mount Sinai. Let me come to a second, I believe, defining moment in Moses' life. You'll find this one in Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13, beginning in verse 31. Now, you know this story is a story of the spies who had to spy out the land. And there were 12, of course. They were trying to figure out what's the best angle to get a military attack going that would be most successful. Now, I'm going to pick it up in a modern translation because it carries a story flow. But, of course, Joshua and Caleb said, yes, with God's help, we can do it. But in Numbers 13, verse 31, it says, the others said, that's the 10, we can't attack these people. They're way stronger than we are. And they began to spread scary rumors among the people of Israel. They said, we scattered out the land from one end to the other. It's huge. Why, we even saw the Nephilim giants. Alongside them, we felt like grasshoppers, and they looked down on us as if we were grasshoppers. Chapter 14, the whole community was in an uproar, wailing all night long. All the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The entire community was in on it. Why didn't we die in Egypt or in this wilderness? Why has God, notice who they're condemning here, why has God brought us to this country just to kill us? Our wives and our children are about to become plunder. Why don't we just head back to Egypt? Verse 4, soon they were all saying to one another, let's pick a new leader. Let's head back to Egypt. Now, Joshua and Caleb tried to dissuade them. Persuade them indeed they could take the land. But verse 10 says, the people said, let's stone them. Now, at this point, they've been 2 years, and they're right up budding up to the land of Canaan. And God says, they have tested me 10 times. And I don't think God, in good conscience, could let this type of people get into the promised land. And the reason is very simple. The land was full of idols. And they weren't gone, Moses wasn't gone, but 40 days before they demanded an idol that to be their God. That was only 2 years before, of course, they got the golden calf. And now they're about to go into a land filled with idols. You know the story, even when they did get into the land a couple hundred years later, it was idolatry that led them away from God. How could God take these people, this slave people, 2 years only into freedom, and who rejected him and his teaching 10 times in the wilderness? So God's decision was simple. I'll start over. Everyone's going to die. But you know the story. Moses does an intercession. 2 things happen. Moses gets his promise, his answer to his prayer, but God still takes all of their life, doesn't he? He takes them one day at a time for 40 years. Now, the reason I think this is significant to Moses is because he's 80 years of age. He would have understood, I know why I was saved when all the other Israelite babies weren't saved. I know why it was Pharaoh's daughter who was the one that spied the basket, opened the basket, and decided to adopt me. I know now why I was in the desert for 40 years. I know now that the promises to Abraham are being fulfilled through me, and we're right up against the land of Canaan to go in. And the judge of all the earth says, 40 years. To Moses, it's a prison sentence. He's going to be how old when he gets out of prison in this case? 120. That land that he wanted to go to, with all the promises to Abraham, is looking slim, isn't it? One of the ancestors, a couple hundred years before, Joseph, only lived to be 110. Now, the next defining moment, I believe, in Moses' life would be in Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. Now, in a desert, of course, water is the principal thing. If you've got oxygen, the next thing you need is water. This happened several times, but in this particular occasion, the animals are bellowing, the babies are crying, and when Moses brought this fact to God, God didn't deny it. Yeah, they needed water. They didn't have water. And we pick the story up in verse 10 of Numbers 20. And it says that Moses, of course, God spoke to him and told him, I'm going to bring you water. Here's what to do. Verse 10. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And he said to them, hear now, you rebels. Must we bring water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And water came out abundantly. And the congregation and their animals drank. So what's the problem? The next verse tells us the problem. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. What a crushing blow to Moses at this point. Now Moses made a major faux pas, and God in good conscience couldn't let Moses go. It seems harsh, doesn't it, at first glance, just for making a silly mistake. But what did Moses and Aaron do? Must we bring water for you out of this rock? What's the problem? You didn't hallow me. Again, it's the idolatry thing. We know once Moses dies, right, God takes him and buries him. We find in the New Testament that the devil disputed with angels about what? Moses' body. Why is that significant? Because the devil wanted Moses' body to raise up and use as a relic. This is your God who brought you out of Egypt. Why do we say that? Well, the Shroud of Turin is still looked at as some sort of talisman. You know, that supposedly covered the body of Christ. In the Soviet Union, 89 years later, I've got Russia today, the body of Lenin, the one who brought revolution to Russia, was embalmed. It's still visible in a glass cage stand. People line up around the block to see the great leader. Imagine what God, what the devil wanted to do with the body of Moses. Idolatry is the problem. Moses was played right into the idolatry. Now, Moses doesn't get to lead them. Moses doesn't get to go in the promised land. But there's a bigger problem. You say, what could be a bigger problem for Moses than that? The bigger problem is no one's going to be there to lead them. Moses, the only educated man, 120. What's the next oldest Israelite? Except for Joshua and Caleb? The oldest one is 60. And their adult experience has been in the desert. Moses was a military man trained by Egypt. They're going to be without a leader. What's Moses afraid of? Well, God threatened to wipe them out numerous times. Now what's going to happen? They're going to go up to the land, enter the land of Canaan. Maybe they'll flake out like they did 38 years before, and the whole plan of God comes to a stop. Moses isn't going to be there. Now all of Israel may not get there. So what is he going to do about it? Well, he was told to write down the law, wasn't he? But he wrote more than that. The Church of God has long perceived that Moses was the primary author of the first five books of the Bible. Why did he write all of that? He was writing it, I had a professor tell me when I was in Israel many years ago, to give a legacy to these people. A historical, legal legacy. So they had something to go by once Moses was gone. And this is significant. Because if you're Moses, you have all this history to write. What are you going to choose to put in this legacy? And so we find Moses picking stories to put in the Bible for the Israelites to give them a legacy and a family history of who they are, specifically for a purpose. We'll get to it in a second. The first one he chooses, I think, for the purpose of this sermon is found in Genesis 9. You don't have to turn there. Genesis 9, verse 20, you know the story. The story that Moses takes is one of Noah. Noah's on this side of the flood. Noah wants some wine, plants a vineyard, makes some grapes, and gets drunk at 500 years of age. You'd think he'd know better by 500 years old. Lying naked in his tent. Moses picks this story. What happens? His younger son, named Ham, does something to him. We're not told what. The Bible doesn't say. So we have theories. Two theories abound around the Church of God that I'm familiar with. The first one is that while Noah's laying there, his younger son Ham comes in and perpetrates an unnatural sexual act on him. Any proof of this? No. All we know is in verse 24, so Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done. Second theory. That is, flows off the idea that God had told Noah and his sons to reproduce and replenish the earth. And so it's in that, by this theory, Noah and his wife are contemplating having more children. But you know human nature. You have three sons, and they're all envisioning their families growing and dominating what they know of the earth. But if Noah's going to have more kids, there's going to be more competition. Everybody's going to have a smaller piece of the pie. So his younger son, Ham, sees an opportune moment, goes into the tent, and makes it impossible for Noah and his wife to have more children because he castrates his father. Now, the reason this theory has more merit is because of what happens next. In verse 25, who does Noah curse? He doesn't curse Ham, the man that did the dirty deed. Who does he curse? Ham's son. And then so Moses picks this story. Ask yourself why. We'll get to it in a second. Verse 25. Here's the curse that Noah placed. Cursed be Canaan. That's Ham's son. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. Blessed be the Lord God of Shem. And may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge the members of Japheth. And may he dwell in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be his servant. Why is Noah cursing Canaan? He didn't do anything. And why does Moses cite this? Moses cites this because whose land were the Israelites going up to take? Canaan's land. Moses is telling them with this story, the prophecies of Noah and the curse on Canaan exist, Israelites. When I'm gone, don't you chicken out. You go in and you take Canaan's land. It's given to you. They're to be your servants. They're to be your slaves. Don't do what you did 38 years ago and flake out. Next incident, I think, that Moses shows that's significant is Genesis chapter 23. Genesis 23 and verse 14. And you ask yourself, why would Moses choose to write this weird little story? What is significant about it? You won't find any significance except for the purpose that we're drawing today. This is about Abraham buying a burial land for his wife. And Abraham is paying 400 shekels of silver for it. We'll begin in Genesis 23 and we'll actually jump down to verse 16. Because here's the account of it. And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth. That's important. These are legal eyewitnesses to a deed being transferred. 400 shekels of currency. Verse 17. So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees that were in the field, which were in it, within all the surrounding borders, were deeded, catch the word, deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gates of the city. Gates of the city where you did business transactions. So this is a deed. And verse 20 summarizes. So the field and the cave that were in it were deeded to Abraham by the sons of Heth as property for a burial place. Why did Moses choose this story? The reason Moses chose this story is because he wants to show that there was a legal precedent set. Now, it's true that Abraham didn't buy all the land. But he's anticipating once Israelites get into the land, they're going to be what happens to the Israelis today. And what's the central question always with the dispute? You Israelites don't belong here. You have no right to this land. Same thing 3,500 years older that Moses is anticipating. So he gives them the story. He says, your ancestor Abraham bought and paid for this land. When you get in there and they say you don't have a right to this land, yes, you do. And that's why Moses chooses that little story that otherwise makes no sense, to give as a legacy to these Israelites who were slave people and who were uneducated and needed guidance once Moses wasn't there. Now, all of the patriarchs we find, nearly all of them, had the similar experience. They were asked by God to get up and leave their country. We find this in Hebrews 11, where the author of Hebrews addresses this. We can begin with Noah. Noah didn't leave just a country. He left an entire world behind, didn't he? And you know the story of Abraham. Get up out of the Ur of the Chaldees. Leave everybody you know. So the author of the book of Hebrews is talking to Jewish Christians. That's why it's called the book of Hebrews. They're Christians, but they know these stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the patriarchs. And the author of Hebrews is bringing this to their attention for a lesson for the Jewish Christians. Beginning in Hebrews 11, verse 9, it says, "By faith Abraham dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in the tent with Isaac and Jacob." In verse 10 it says, "For he waited for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God." He knew that was the real inheritance, not the land of Canaan. In verse 16, after talking about the patriots, it says, "But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." Now, if you're a first generation, what we call a first generation Christian in this room, you may well understand a little bit of what Abraham and Moses and Joseph, who was taken out in a foreign country, all went through. Because if you had a battle in your own family growing up, you know what it's like to be disinherited or suffer dislocation from your own family. In my own instance, I didn't grow up in the church. At age 17, I came in contact with Church of God literature. And I mused about keeping a seventh-day Sabbath out loud to my mother, because that appears to be what the Bible taught. And she says, "You will not do so and live in this house." Well, I lived in a farm in Minnesota, and every person was needed to work on the farm. I knew what she meant. So I didn't. I worked all summer long at age 17 on my dad's farm, and I hated every Saturday that came along. I'm out in the field looking at the sun, wishing it would go down, because the guilt was unbearable. Finally, at the end of the summer, I got down on my knees and I said, "Okay, God, I can't stand it anymore. I know I'm going to start to keep a Sabbath. I'm going to get kicked out of the house, sure as the world. I didn't want to know about this Sabbath. You told it to me. I don't even have a high school degree. You're going to have to take care of me." So I told my mother next Friday night. She told my father, and they were taken aback, but I was their firstborn son. They didn't know if they were making a mistake or not, so they gave me some latitude. Maybe it's a phase he's going to grow out of. And so I survived. If you've grown up in the church, you know what it's like to be like a patriarch. Now, you don't think he did a first example, but every time you have to go to this, what? This Feast of Tabernacles that nobody can pronounce? You know you're different. Friday night comes around, there's a big separation between you, and the other kids aren't there. And there's nothing a teenager growing up wants to be more than to be considered normal. It's like a normal kid. But you know that you're not. And when Christmas time comes around, the other kids all get gifts, and teacher asks, "Well, what did you get?" And you, "Oh, got something like this for Christmas." I have a youngest daughter who's in middle school. She has an Indian kid from India. And he says, "Tell me again, what are those things about the days of 11 bread?" So she knows she's different. Well, everybody in the Bible, all of the writings point to a major event. Whether it's the apostles' letters, the eyewitness accounts of Christ, whether it's the books of Moses, or the Psalms of David, or the writing of the prophets, they all point to one thing. There is a country coming down from heaven, one that those with the Holy Spirit are going to inherit. And when that happens, first, second generation, Abraham, it doesn't matter. Never again the people of God be called a people without a country.